WBUR. From WVUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The FCC let out big media's leash today in the biggest rewrite in a generation. The commission loosened regulations against owning multiple print and broadcast outlets in the same city. FCC Chairman Michael Powell said that the vote would bring the American media closer to diversity, localism, and competition, and further from what he called the graying rules of a black and white era. Critics of the move fear that even with 500 channels, fewer hands in charge of content make for bad democracy. The FCC's 3-2 party line vote came in against sharp public opposition, and in the wake of reported luxury trips for FCC bigwigs paid for by telecommunications and broadcast giants. Today, there was a loud hurrah when media stocks rallied on Wall Street. Tonight, media moguls are toasting their hard-fought victory and planning the expansion of their empires. But what's in it for you, your town, your city, your country? This hour on Point, media giants shake off their chains. Are you ready for big media unbound? Has the FCC struck a blow for hegemony or healthy diversity? Do you fear that a welcome new, or fear or welcome a new concentration of media ownership in your community? And is the FCC knocking down important protection against mega media or just waking up to the times? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me tonight from Bethesda, Maryland is Mark Gunther, writer for Fortune Magazine. Good evening and welcome, Mark Gunther.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. And joining us from Madison, Wisconsin is John Nichols, editor of the Capital Times, the daily newspaper in Madison, co-author with Robert McChesney of Our Media, Not Theirs, The Democratic Struggle Against Corporate Media, and political writer for The Nation. Good evening and welcome back, John Nichols.
It's great to be with you.
It's good to have you. Mark Gunther, take us in first, if you would. Can you outline for us, and I know there are lots of details here, but give us in broad stroke the detail of the loosening that will flow out of the FCC's regulatory revamp today.
I'll do my best. You're right, it's a complicated issue. But I think the FCC did, in essence, four things. First of all, it raised the national ownership cap. This is the number of TV stations that any one company can own, from the current 35% to stations covering 45% of the country.
That is, one owner's stations would reach could now reach 45% of American television viewers?
That's correct. There is an asterisk because UHF stations, those that are higher than Channel 13, count slightly less. So actually, it could be more than 45%.
Anyway, a single broadcaster can now have a greater slice of mind share, as it were.
Nationally.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
All the rest of the rules affect local ownership.
Mm-hmm.
They lifted a rule that said that a newspaper and a television station could not be under the same owner in the same city.
Which means, in effect, that now, in all likelihood, it will be newspaper companies reaching out to buy TV stations, not the other way around.
Either or both.
Okay.
They lifted, to a very limited degree, the cross-ownership local rules between radio and television stations. Won't have a lot of effect, but again, they did make it easier for TV and radio stations to be owned by the same company in the same town.
Mm-hmm.
And then they also liberalized the rules for ownership of local television stations. In the smaller markets, companies can now own two stations. In the larger ones, they could own three.
Now, you call all of those last three elements local, and I guess they are, but it also does mean that large national corporations, media corporations, in particular localities, could also exercise those new freedoms.
Yeah, and I think you're right in what you said in the introduction, which is, generally speaking, this is going to lead to the big companies getting bigger by swallowing some of the smaller fish that are out there.
Mark, you're with Fortune, and watching the business side of this, can you give us a kind of a picture of what the media business is anticipating? Who's going to be buying whom? What kind of purchases are likely to ensue? What particular purchases are people waiting to see happen?
I think in the beginning, despite the huge amount of public attention and protest devoted to this issue, we're going to see relatively small-scale deals. By contrast, about 10 years ago, the government lifted a much more arcane rule with much less discussion that allowed television networks to own more of the programming they put on, again, done without a lot of debate. That led to mergers like ABC and Disney coming together, Viacom and CBS. I mean, huge deals. This is more likely to be A company like a Viacom or a News Corporation, both of which already own a lot of TV stations, they're right at the cap. They will be picking up more TV stations opportunistically in markets where stations are for sale. You might also see, as we discussed a moment ago, a local newspaper buying a TV station or vice versa.
But if you're a Knight Ridder newspaper chain or a New York Times or some other large print company tonight, is it likely that you've got your business managers looking at every town where you publish a newspaper and saying, shall we consider buying a television station there as well?
I think the question they will be asking is that one, but an even more fundamental one, which is, as this next wave of consolidation comes, and as I say, I don't think it's going to be dramatic at first, do we want to be a buyer or a seller? In other words, if I'm a Knight Ridder or a Gannett and I own a newspaper, do I want to buy a TV station or do I want to, in effect, put my newspaper on the market and try and extract as much value as I can for it?
And if they were to put – oh, you're saying the newspaper has become more valuable because whoever does own it can reach out and grab that television station as well.
Well, also because they could sell it. In other words, right now there are more buyers for virtually every TV station and every newspaper in America. So the value of all these media properties on a local level today is more than it was yesterday.
Mark Gunther, we're going to be talking tonight a lot, I'm sure, about what's going to happen to the quality of news and programming as a result of this. But what about the simple business dynamic? Does it always make sense for the local paper to consider buying the TV station? What are the advantages of consolidation?
You know, I think that's a good question, and I think in general, if we look back over the last 5 or 10 years, a lot of the media deals, particularly these big sweeping deals, have not turned out to have great financial benefit. I mean, look at AOL Time Warner as the kind of ugliest example. And that's one reason I think the buyers and sellers will proceed with real caution here. They're going to have to feel that there are some gains to be made before they will turn around and do these deals. I think the set of deals we're first going to see, as I said, is Viacom, which owns both the CBS and UPN networks, and News Corporation, which owns the Fox networks, going out and picking up more TV stations one at a time, perhaps two or three at a time. Right now, Viacom, I think, has 39 stations in all. News Corporation has 34. I think you will see those numbers grow. But just a quick side note, neither NBC, which is owned by GE, or ABC, which is owned by Disney, are even close to the 35% cap now. So in other words, they've had the freedom to go out and buy stations for the last however many years. That's why I think on some level there's been an awful lot of hype and exaggeration about what this is going to mean, particularly in terms of the so-called media giants getting that much bigger, because they've had the opportunity to grow and they haven't taken advantage of it.
Mark Gunther, stand by. We want to have you there as a reference on the business side tonight and perhaps more, but I want to turn to you, John Nichols, in Madison, Wisconsin, if I may. You have been a very outspoken opponent of this in your writing and again today on the web. What are your feelings tonight with this vote taken, with the deed done, the regulations loosened?
Well, we're popping our champagne corks out here in the media reform movement. And I hate to try and give you too much spin, so I won't, but I will tell you this. While we are terribly disappointed in this vote, and when I say we, I mean working journalists, civil rights activists, consumers, all the millions of people who opposed this move, we're delighted by the fact that the communications conglomerates overreached. They went so far that, as Commissioner Michael Copps, one of the dissenters in the vote, said today, they awakened the sleeping giant of the American people. There is an opposition to the conglomeration, consolidation, and monopolization of our media today that simply wasn't there before. And I think it's going to grow, become more passionate, and ultimately see not just the reversal of these rule changes, but a real shift in how we debate media ownership in this country, and ultimately a movement back toward what Jefferson and Madison intended, which was a nation with broad ownership of our media, where we had a real cacophony of voices, not a one-size-fits-all homogenized news and culture, which is what would come if these rule changes were allowed to go to their complete extent.
John Nichols, we'll talk about that, but isn't the horse already out of the barn? The vote was taken today. The FCC has handed down the ruling. Won't media companies begin to act on this tomorrow morning?
Well, in fact, the action began already. Even before the vote was taken, we saw speculation in the trade press about who would be buying what. And we also saw many of these companies putting a lot of money away to begin their buying sprees. And certainly stockholders noted that, and stock buyers noted that this afternoon, as you saw major media companies increase in value, in actual value, by 3 to 5%.
So what's the cause for your optimism? We understand that people rallied in opposition to this. Nevertheless, it went through. These purchases, this consolidation, to whatever extent it goes on, will begin to happen. Won't that create, to use a phrase, facts on the ground that will be very hard to reverse?
It may. I mean, there's no question it's going to be a challenge. But here's the interesting part of it. When the Telecommunications Act of 1996 was passed, and it was just as bad in many ways as these rule changes, there was very little real national organized opposition. And in fact, we were dead in Congress. I mean, there was very few votes against, not nearly what there should have been. Now, already, we have more than 150 members of Congress, from conservatives like Trent Lott, all the way over to Vermont's Bernie Sanders, who's the only announced socialist in Congress, saying that these rule changes must be reversed. Today, Trent Lott said that, for instance, on the lifting of the cap to 45% for the television, that he thinks the votes are there in the Senate to reverse it. We also know that because of the horrifically inept way that these rule changes were advanced, with very little public commentary, very little research, comically poor actions by a regulatory agency, the commissioners Copps and Adelstein are right. This will unleash a torrent of lawsuits, legal actions, and all sorts of challenges, which means that our other guest is right tonight. There is a very good chance that some companies will go slowly because they know, A, there is a good chance that Congress is going to move, and B, there is a very good chance that a great deal of this is going to end up in the courts for a very long time to come.
John Nichols, the chairman of the FCC, Michael Powell, said today, and of course this is the son of Secretary of State Colin Powell, said today repeatedly that these loosened regulations will encourage, in the U.S. media, will encourage competition, diversity, and local content. Your view?
He had to say that. That's what the FCC is required to protect. So he had to say those magic words, diversity, competition, and localism. In fact, he also should have, although I don't think he had his script exactly right, talked a lot about the public interest, because the FCC is also supposed to defend that. The fact is, that's just spin. It's completely meaningless. And no one, no honest player in this debate would agree with that. If you look at what was said by every major consumer group, every major union and organization representing journalists, every major grouping in labor and religious and public interest areas, is a universal outcry against these changes, exactly because they will reduce diversity, competition, and localism, and also because they will undermine the public interest that the FCC is supposed to protect.
Mark Gunther, come in here. I'm not sure what to make of this. On the one hand, we assume the champagne corks will be popping in New York in media centers tonight. John Nichols is saying there's been such a riling up of the public that he's confident this is not going to happen. Is doubt about how this will all turn out in the courts and elsewhere likely to slow down media concentration?
Yeah, I think I agree with John on most of the things that he said. The process was abysmal. It certainly would be open to legal challenge. It was not done in anything approaching a fair-minded or open-minded way. I think the end result of this process was known when it began. Having said that, one reason the process began is that every effort by the FCC over the last 5 years to regulate media ownership has been struck down by the courts as not being able to be defended in a court of law because there wasn't the evidence to support, for example, a 35 versus a 45% cap. So once it goes into the courts, it's anybody's guess as how it's going to come out. Very, very difficult to come up with a compelling rationale for regulation of media ownership. You and I may think it promotes diversity and choice, but the evidence isn't that strong, and that's one reason the FCC moved on this, is because every rule they've put forward in the last few years has been overturned.
We'll come back and look at that. We're talking tonight about Big Media Unbound and the FCC's big loosening today of who can own what in American newspapers and television. You can join the conversation. What is the world of media we are jumping into? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about big media, Unbound, and the FCC's big loosening today of who can own what in American newspapers and television. My guest tonight, Mark Gunther, a writer for Fortune magazine, joining us from Bethesda, Maryland. From Madison, Wisconsin, John Nichols, editor of the Capital Times in Madison, and co-author of Our Media, Not Theirs, The Democratic Struggle Against Corporate Media. You can join the conversation as well. Has the FCC struck a blow for hegemony or for diversity today? Would your local television station be diminished if a newspaper buys it, or enhanced? And is the FCC knocking down vital protection against domination by media giants, or just waking up to the times? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Steve is calling from Falmouth, Massachusetts. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Greetings.
Greetings.
I got to say, I feel like I've been kicked in the gut after this kind of ruling. This is nothing but the big lie is put out by the FCC chairman. This is going to do exactly the opposite of the BS that he said there. It's going to consolidate power in the hands of the few. It's part of the Bush program here to consolidate wealth in the hands of the few. I mean, we're going to go back in time over the Bush reign here saying, boy, what couldn't they figure out how to concentrate in the hands of the wealthy?
But, Steve, if your local newspaper owns your local TV station, do you feel not as well served?
Absolutely. What about little things that aren't moneymakers that these people are going to try and turn into moneymakers? Are they going to broadcast a local Little League game? Why? There's nothing in it for them. This is all going to be bottom line stuff for these people. What are the assets worth? What can they wring out of them?
So you don't trust the goodwill or the public interest of the FCC in this move?
The FCC is a government organ, and it follows the party line of the government. And our government's party line at this particular point is let the wealth roll on.
Let the wealth roll on. Steve, thanks for your call. I want to turn to John Sturm, who's joining us tonight from Washington, D.C. He's president of the Newspaper Association of America. Good evening. Welcome, John Sturm.
Thank you, Tom.
You just heard there from one caller saying he felt like he was kicked in the stomach by the ruling today. How are newspaper owners receiving the FCC ruling?
Well, newspaper owners are pretty, pleased by the fact that we've been under the thumb of the government now for three decades. Only felons, convicted felons, aliens, that being people from their foreign nationals, and newspaper publishers have been ineligible to own local broadcast stations. That's it. And today that changed, and that's a good thing. And most importantly, it's a good thing for those who really desire and want local news in their marketplace, in their home community. Because best of all, newspapers are now going to be able to own local broadcast stations. And that's good news for the providers of local news in the community.
Well, why is that, John?
Newspapers are the source of local news. And so, therefore, a lot of television stations that are starting to drop local news in general are going to be able to be acquired by newspapers, and that means more local news in the community. And in radio, for example, all news radio has only made it in the big markets. That's because of this rule. The economics of all news radio means that it's a very expensive proposition. If a newspaper owns a radio station, what is more natural than an all-news format, even in smaller markets?
So, John Sturm, let me ask you, you're countering the argument that concentration is the evil here with the argument saying newspapers can bring more resources to electronic or broadcast media. But what about the concentration issue, that this leaves that publisher potentially dominating the worldview, the news of his community to an extent that may make it vulnerable to, I don't know, a particular political agenda or take on the world?
Hey, Tom, this rule has not been in effect in 40 markets since the day it was put into effect in 1975. 40 markets were, at least 40 markets, were grandfathered since 1975. Markets the size of Miles City, Montana, on the small side, to Chicago, Illinois, on the top side. Mm. In those three decades, do you think anybody's dominated anything in Chicago? The Chicago Tribune, which owns WGN, mm-hmm. television, mm-hmm. and radio, has not even been able to dominate the newspaper market in Chicago. It's one of the few cities that has, relatively few cities, that has more than one daily newspaper.
John Sturm, stand by. I want to put that question to John Nichols in Madison. John Nichols, what do you make of this argument that newspapers buying televisions will actually be better for local communities? They'll get more local news.
Well, as somebody who has worked for newspapers since I was 11 years old and rode my bike down Main Street in Union Grove, Wisconsin to report for duty at the Union Grove Sun, I can tell you that nobody who works as a journalist on a newspaper believes what Mr. Sturm has just said.
And why not? That you can, it's not that difficult to see some logic in it. Newspapers gather a lot of news. They can put it out in print. They can put it out electronically. Why wouldn't that work?
First off, those of us who work as journalists in this business have a great respect for the real underpinnings of the First Amendment and the freedom of the press. We know that that was all about the role that a diverse, cacophonous media plays in feeding and nurturing democracy and our culture. That happens when you have a lot of different owners and a lot of different voices coming from different perspectives. During the course of this debate, I've spoken in dozens of cities across this country, including Chicago and Columbus and a number of other cities, where they do have this grandfather situation where the newspaper owns television and radio. After every one of those speeches, I received either an email or a call or somebody just coming up to me who said, look, I work in one of these consolidated newsrooms. I do the newspaper story, and then I've been trained to do the appearance on radio and TV and to do the Internet story. And I'll tell you, my journalism suffers and the community suffers because ultimately there's only one voice producing all that news. Mr. Sturm speaks of Chicago, where there are still two newspapers, although no one in Chicago would suggest that the Tribune does not dominate. But in Columbus, for instance, the other newspapers closed down, and you have a situation where you truly do have increasingly a one-size-fits-all homogenized news, which people in the community complain about, which working journalists complain about, and which anybody who's an honest player in this ought to be concerned about.
John Sturm, how about it? You hear the argument there, and you also have surely seen the public fury over this ruling, even in advance of it coming down. How do you explain that, the high level of skepticism about this that appears to be out there in the public?
Well, people can speculate all they want, but the fact of the matter is the FCC studies and independent studies done, for example, by the Pew Project in Journalism, conclude very specifically that newspaper-owned broadcast stations in those grandfathered markets do more and better news and public affairs than any other stations in the market. It's just a simple fact. And we can guess about this and guess about that. And the commission has to do a little bit of prognostication with some of these other rules they did. But on the newspaper side, the evidence is very, very clear. Newspaper-owned broadcast television stations do more and better news and public affairs than everybody else.
But John Sturm, you hear John Nichols raising, and we've all seen the furor that's been out there, the apparently kind of instinctive rallying to the idea of a cacophonous media that the public seems to support. Doesn't this fly in the face of that?
Hang on a second. When's the last time you heard an editorial on a television station?
Not often.
No, you've never heard an editorial on television.
Well, I have, but it hasn't been
often. Wisconsin every night.
The fact of the matter is, very, very few television stations do editorial.
What's your point?
Very, very few. My point is that the tradition of newspapers is for journalistic independence and for presenting real live viewpoints, whether it be on newspapers or in those 40 markets on air. And the fact of the matter is, the best chance there is for the public to receive more and better local news and perhaps a different viewpoint that they've never heard on television is if a newspaper owns a television station or, most importantly, a radio station.
But how do you explain what appears to be a kind of negative gut reaction in the American public to the very concentration that you're lauding here?
Unfortunately, a lot of folks have been out there trying to scare the public into worrying about people like Rupert Murdoch, who has only in the last 20 years sold newspapers in the United States, and five big media companies, all of whom put together own one newspaper. That is a Murdoch newspaper in New York, the New York Post. That's it. The scare tactics have been out there, and the fact of the matter is, in local markets, newspaper ownership means more and better for the local community.
Johnstrom, how many markets do you expect will see the consolidation of newspaper and TV ownership?
Frankly, not all that many. Those are economic decisions that are going to be made by a lot of business folks out there. And there's a split. Some people think that it will be economically sound. Others are not so sure. But that's okay. The most important thing is we have gotten the government, for the first time in three decades, off the backs of the newspaper industry. I'll say it again. Only convicted felons, foreign nationals, and newspapers have been ineligible to own local broadcast stations, and that's wrong in today's media marketplace.
Mark Gunther, you hear Johnstrom, who speaks for newspaper owners, and it's a glad day in his view, and all should celebrate.
I want to correct one thing that John just said. The newspaper owners are not unable to buy television stations. At the moment, they've just been unable to buy them in their own market. Obviously, mm-hmm. Knight Ridder, Times Mirror, New York Times, Washington Post have all owned television stations over the years, so it's not like they can't get in the business. Having said that, I do agree with him. There's been a lot of scare tactics out there, and one of the unquestioned assumptions of this whole debate, which I'd like to question right now, is that small is good and big is bad. I've worked on small newspapers. I now work for the biggest media company in the world, AOL Time Warner. And I have to tell you, that truism just does not apply. If you look at local independent television stations and newspapers, you will find some of the greatest media owners in America who care about their communities, who are involved, who invest in news, who have strong values. And you will also find some of the absolutely most irresponsible, uncaring, corrupt owners of these smaller properties.
Well, let's just take that for a minute. But, Mark Gunther, who would have an interest in scare tactics around this issue?
You know, it's a good question. I actually would agree with John Nichols probably on 90 out of 100 issues that he would write about, and I don't really see this as an issue that's a left versus a right issue. The media critics out there have whipped the public up into a frenzy against corporate media. I mean, let me just make one other factual point. Mm. When I grew up in New York, a big city in the 1950s and 60s, we had three networks, television stations, and three independent stations, and that was our source for broadcast news. Mm-hmm. Today, you've got three full-time, 24-hour cable news networks. You've got a business news network, Weather Channel. I mean, I don't see how anyone can argue that diversity or democracy are at risk in the United States today. There is more information out there than ever before. There's more good information out there than ever before. You have PBS, NPR, the Internet. No one who really wants to be informed in this country can say, I can't get information.
And yet we can feel that kind of unease, that desire to defend the cacophony that John Nichols talks about. I want to turn to our callers. Rob's calling from Wellesley, Massachusetts. Hi, Rob. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you very much, guys. I have to say up front, I haven't read the order yet, but I've been following it pretty closely. And I thank you very much, Mark, for making a few points earlier, which is that the problem with this is that the courts have rejected the FCC's efforts every single time to try to put ownership caps on. So it really is a who decides issue. The court has said the FCC has to justify the limits that they have, and they have not been limited to this point. So you can't really blame the FCC for this stuff. It really comes down to if Congress wants to put limits on it, Congress needs to do it expressly.
It has to be Congress. Thanks for your call, Rob. John Nichols, what about that? Michael Powell, the FCC chairman, said today, look, we're being challenged in the courts, and if we don't act strongly, the courts are going to reject what we've done. This is going to happen. Are the courts where the real momentum is here, and why?
Well, certainly the courts did put some pressure on the FCC in regard to some of these aspects. But I think it's very important to remember that much of this has not yet been visited upon by the courts. We'll see what the courts say. I think one of the critical problems that we have in this discussion is an assumption that the FCC was somehow in the 1980s and 1990s on a rampage to try and control or limit media ownership. That wasn't the case. Former FCC Commissioner Nick Johnson says that since the mid-1970s, the FCC has been the tool of media owners, that it has abandoned its public interest responsibilities, and again moved to make it easier for big media to own more television, more radio, more newspapers. And obviously with Congress, a very often corrupted Congress on these issues, going along. And I want to address one other thing, just if I can here.
Mm-hmm.
This suggestion that people were whipped into a frenzy on this issue by those of us who actually work in the media, those of us who actually are journalists.
Mm-hmm.
I just would point out that the National Association of Hispanic Journalists, the National Association of Black Journalists, Unity, the umbrella coalition for all minority journalists in the U.S., the Newspaper Guild, AFTRA, the radio and television unions, groups like Society of Professional Journalists, all said this is a very bad idea. The only people in media who argued for doing this change are the owners. And they did not argue because they care about freedom of the press or because they care about the quality of news or because they care about the communities that they supposedly serve. They pushed these changes because they wanted to make more money. And they will, if they're allowed to go ahead with this, make more money. But they will not create a better media. And I also finally would just challenge this small versus big notion. I've worked for big media and for small media. And I can tell you, the bottom line is that often it is the small individual owner who dares to challenge the accepted wisdom who makes the big difference. And this is an assault on the small individual owner. It's also something that the public recognizes is terribly dangerous because a one-size-fits-all media will not ultimately serve the public debate or the culture.
John Sturm, is this newspaper owners out to maximize profit and the devil take the hindmost?
I am appalled by someone who pretends to be a defender of the public interest who will tolerate the government saying no to the most penetrating and in-depth media there is out there today. The one media who is willing to write an editorial, do an op-ed, and challenge the government. I am appalled by someone who worked for that medium who says the government should continue to keep their hands on the mouths of the newspaper medium and not allow them to own broadcast media when everybody else virtually essentially in the country can do so. I'm suggesting to you that that is not pro-competitive and it is not pro-First Amendment, and I think the gentleman is dead wrong.
Well, there we've got it. John Sturm, I know we have to let you go, but thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
John Sturm joined us from Washington, D.C. He is president of the Newspaper Association of America. Mark Gunther, John Nichols, please stand by. We're talking tonight about big media, Unbound, and the FCC's big loosening today of who can own what in American newspapers and television. Did you raise your voice for or against these new looser regulations? Were you heard? And should media ownership be more regulated than other industries? Where is the U.S. media headed after today's FCC vote? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about big media Unbound and the FCC's big loosening today of who can own what in American newspapers and television. You can join the conversation. Do you fear or welcome consolidation of media ownership in your town? Where is American media headed after today's big FCC vote? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guests tonight are Mark Gunther, writer for Fortune Magazine, joining us from Bethesda, Maryland. John Nichols, joining us from Madison, Wisconsin, editor of the Capital Times and a political writer for The Nation. We are joined now from Westchester, New York, by Jim Rutherford, executive vice president of Verona Sewler Stevenson, a media merchant bank. Good evening and welcome, Jim Rutherford.
Good evening, Tom.
Thanks for joining us. Jim, what do you anticipate in terms of consolidation ensuing from the FCC ruling today? How much? How widespread? How eagerly will newspapers and TV owners jump into buying one another?
I think there's going to be a moderate level of consolidation here. I don't think we're going to see the massive consolidation or mergers that some people have commented on. I think you'll see television station owners buying some more television stations in markets where they can have duopolies. You will see the networks buying a few more stations to become owned and operated stations. And I think there will be a couple of newspapers that will buy either TV stations or radio or both.
Jim, a duopoly is what?
Duopoly is where you can own two stations in the same market.
Mm-hmm. You know, we saw a fairly famous radio consolidation in the 90s after some previous legislation. Is it possible that once this gains steam, we could see something similar here?
Don't really think so. Not the way these rules read. They are going to leave four or five or six different stations, and you won't see the kind of wholesale consolidation you saw in the radio market, at least not under these rules.
So you represent media companies when they go out to buy or to sell, I guess.
Correct.
What are the selling points that you're describing to potential clients who may want to buy or sell about why they should do it now that the rules have been changed?
Well, in the case where you can buy two stations in the same market, there are definitely both cost savings that can occur when you buy two stations. There are also some chances to increase the revenues through combination selling of advertising across two different stations and through a lot of cross-promotion. The newspaper cross-ownership, it's a harder economic argument to make in the near term, but there's a good...
You mean when a newspaper owns a television station?
When a newspaper owns a television station in the same market, not a lot of near-term economic benefits, but probably some very good long-term benefits to providing more quality news to the television station from the newspaper, which long-term is good for the economics of the television station.
And long-term, what do you think this does to competition in the U.S. media? If you were in a city or town where your competition got a lot bigger through an acquisition permitted under this fresh ruling, does that make your life harder? Does it diminish competition?
I'm not sure that it does diminish competition. In some cases, it might slightly diminish competition. In others, I buy the argument that you actually will get, when you have more well-financed ownership, you may have greater diversity of programming. One of the problems that you have in the free over-the-air media now, particularly television, is that the smaller stations, the independent stations or quasi-independent stations, are defaulting more and more to home shopping formats, paid programming. It's really getting worse and worse in terms of the quality of the programming because the economics make it hard for the station owners, the smaller and mid-sized station owners, to buy quality programming or to produce their own news. So hopefully this will actually allow some stations to stay on the air that would otherwise go off the air, or allow stations to program something other than just home shopping and some paid programming.
Jim Rutherford, thanks for joining us to bring another business perspective tonight.
You're welcome.
Jim Rutherford is Executive Vice President of Verona Sewler Stevenson. He joined us from Westchester, New York. Jessica is calling from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Hi, Jessica. You're on the air.
Hi. I was listening to your show, a really good show, by the way.
Thank you.
And I just had kind of a comment or insight to add to the earlier guest who was saying that he didn't think it was going to take anything away from competition.
Mm-hmm.
My dad and I run a couple of classified sites online, and they're just local classified sites.
These are internet classified sites where people can buy and sell things, okay?
Exactly. And the one thing we've come across when trying to advertise these sites is the local newspapers and also the Journal Sentinel, which is a large paper here. They don't really allow us to put ads in the paper. We called and we tried to place an ad like any paying customer would.
Because your service competes with theirs.
Exactly. And now they also own Clear Channel, the company that owns most of the billboards, which we were trying to get a billboard. We can't advertise on Clear Channel's billboards either because they're owned by the same company that owns the Journal, and that's also competition. So now, you know, the only two mediums really left as far as big advertising to us are radio and television.
That's a pretty interesting situation. Stand by, Jessica. Mark Gunther, what do you make of that? Here's an internet site owner who wants to compete with big media. Big media doesn't want to run her ads.
I don't like it at all.
But I'm on her side there.
But isn't that only going to get worse?
But the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, I'm not 100% sure, but I believe that is one of these locally owned papers that John Nichols wants to cheer for. In other words, I don't think it's the small, big issue.
If I can interrupt, Mark.
John Nichols.
It's one of the grandfather situations where they also own radio and television, and they just merged two newspapers, closing down one. So they're not my poster child for the way to do it.
In fact,
John, aren't they locally owned, though? They're not part of a big conglomerate.
You are right, but they have consolidated and conglomerated and formed the model for what I'm opposed to. It's not that I am solely a champion of local ownership, although I think it's preferable. I am also a champion of diverse ownership. I think you should have different people owning radio, television, and newspapers in the same market. I think it's healthy. And I think our caller would be better served by that, because you don't have this one-size-fits-all operation that really does try to get control. Not only does the Journal Sentinel own the newspaper, radio station, television station, they also have been on a buying spree buying up suburban weeklies all through the region.
I have to feel there. That's where you need a really strong attorney general or someone to deal with what sound on the face of it to me like antitrust issues there.
Well,
they're monopolizing too much of a local market, but that's not so much an FCC issue. That's where is the Attorney General of the state of Wisconsin here?
And yet the FCC ruling today lets us go further in that direction. Jessica, thanks for your call from Milwaukee. Rose is calling from Boston. Hi, Rose. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I was calling to say I think that technology requires us to think about how we create democracy or don't in a different way.
It sure does.
I can look at the example of farm ownership. I don't know what the current statistics are exactly. I forget, but I know that it's a very small percentage of people now who own farms,
mm-hmm.
and who are able to live off of their own independent economic venture.
Our time's running up. You're making a parallel with the media world, Rose?
I think that the concentration of anything that's part of how we run our society and how we feed ourselves and how we live is a bad thing in itself.
And there's a vote against it. Rose, thanks for your call. John Nichols, you started out here expressing optimism, and yet I can feel, anyone can hear in your voice, a sense of foreboding about what may ensue from today's ruling. What do you see coming?
Well, look, there is a sense of foreboding, because if the coalitions that came together to oppose these rule changes don't hold together and don't continue to fight and continue to put pressure on Congress to reverse them and to begin really writing media laws that nurture and protect democracy, then we're in terribly bad shape in this country. I could give you a very quick anecdote. Folks set up a table at the farmers market here in Madison, Wisconsin, not at my behest or at that of any national group, to collect petition signatures against these rule changes. And one woman held a sign saying stop media monopoly, and then, you know, people came over. They ran into a problem. They had so many people coming to the table, they didn't have enough pens. And the thing that they told me was they didn't have to explain to anyone the danger of having consolidated media ownership. Everybody came up saying, I'm against it.
Everybody knew. With that, we're out of time, but the rules have changed. John Nichols, I want to thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
John Nichols is editor of the Capital Times in Madison, Wisconsin. And Mark Gunther, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Mark Gunther writes for Fortune magazine. In a moment, an astronaut reflects on 6 months in orbit. This is On Point. NASA astronaut Captain Kenneth Bowersox had quite a memorable and trying 6 months in space recently. Captain Bowersox, along with NASA Space Station science officer Don Pettit and Russian cosmonaut Nikolai Budarin, were at work on the International Space Station in February when they learned of the destruction of the space shuttle Columbia. As a result of that tragedy, Bowersox, Pettit, and Budarin were stuck in space for an extra 2 months. When they did return to Earth last month, they endured a harrowing reentry, landing in a remote Kazakhstan area some 300 miles from their targeted touchdown site. We caught up with Captain Bowersox back on Earth. In this radio diary, he talks about his 161 days in orbit, the loss of his friends on Columbia, his waiting game in space, and a wild ride back home to Earth.
One thing that amazed me is I was never once bored. There was always something to do. It's almost like you're overstimulated because there's constantly something new and something exciting to see or do. But as part of all that, I found that my emotions were a little more noticeable when I was in orbit. And if I was sad, I might feel a little sadder. If I was happy, I'd feel happy and my feet would start dancing around in the zero-G dance. I mean, it was as if for some reason I could feel more and feel more deeply.
I think the hardest part of the 6 months we spent in orbit was losing our friends on Columbia. That's hard whether you're on the ground or whether you're in space, whether you're on an airplane or in a car. Losing friends is always terrible, and it was tough to work through. The accident made us go into a different mode of operation. Before that, we were doing our best to keep things light and try to banter with the ground. And they were trying to keep us livened up, and we were honestly getting ready to come home. The mission to pick us up was only about a month away, but then after the accident, we had to be much more careful about what we said and how we said it. We needed to think about the difficult situation that our ground team was in. We tried to think about supporting them, as hard as it must be to be surrounded by the news reports of the accident and the criticism that would probably follow, whether it was warranted or not. And we also had to think about how to get the best result out of the extra time that we were going to be given. The extra time we were given was a positive. We were happy to spend the extra 2 months up there. The environment is such a great place. It's so rich for discovery. We learned a lot of new things about ourselves and had new ideas for science activities, and that made the time very, very valuable to us. Although our entry mode was not what we expected, the ride was always within our limits to tolerate it, and the actual touchdown was softer. And then after we landed and opened the hatch, it was really nice to be out there in the steppe of Kazakhstan looking at the grass all the way to the horizon, the blue skies, the little white birds flying around. I can't imagine a better way to be received on your home planet. Humans are made to go into space. We're going to explore, and someday we're going to leave the planet. I choose to participate in that effort. I think it's something that our ancestors are going to be proud of us for 100 years from now, 200 years from now, 300 years from now, however long it takes. It's not my decision, though. It's a decision of Congress and the American people, and we'll go through public debate. But my vote is to do it, and I vote with the choice of career that I've made. I think I appreciate most the effect and the need that we have for the people around us. When you're up in a closed environment with only two other people, you have support, you have constant communication with people on the ground. But something that was really hammered home to me is that when you're around other people, they lift your spirits or bring your spirits down in a way that's almost subconscious. When you're constantly surrounded by people and the stimulation of our society, you don't really notice it. But when you come back from space, you notice it right away. And it makes you realize that it's important to respect all the people around you and never to take the people that you love for granted.
NASA astronaut Captain Kenneth Bowersox returned home to planet Earth last month. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Aline Amata, Tamar Morad, Virginia Prescott, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog, with help from Chris O'Connor. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you.